Good evening, everybody. My name is Mike Cook, and I'm an alcoholic. I think I've got the right equipment. First of all, I would really like to take the time to thank the committee for allowing me to host this weekend and for putting this great roundup together. They worked very hard. At this time, if the people on the committee would stand up. What a wonderful job you've done. My job tonight is to introduce the speaker. And the best thing that I can really say about the speaker tonight is when I met him at the airport, I had a little badge on where he'd recognize me. And he walked up and he had a big grin on his face. He said, "Hello, fellas, how you doing?" And I tell you right now, you know, when you're standing there waiting on somebody, And they got that glow about them and that grin about them, and we have just had a wonderful time together. And with that, I give you Ken.
Hi, I'm Ken, an alcoholic. Glad to be here, Marietta. Golly. Lit in my navel is dancing, you know. It's a, you guys sure do talk a lot about not having sex down here, I tell you. I want to thank Doug and Charles and Joyce and everybody on the committee for inviting me down here, and of course Mike and Jim for picking me up at the airport and taking me on 285 South to Macon. And you know, you just know you're with the right guys when you're heading in the wrong direction, and they look at each other and go, we're going the wrong way. Yeah, but we're heading away from the airport. Well, you think we might be able to get off and go the right way? We could get off, well, a little too late for that one. How about, I guess we're just a little bit past that now. Well, why don't we just go to Macon, the hell with it. You know, we're moving away from the airport, and so far, no traffic, you know. These are the kind of guys I got sober with, you know, like, whoa. You're a regular road runner, Sparky. This is good stuff, you know. I got sober with guys who say, "There's a dead bird." They look up. Like, yeah, I'm gonna pick that up. This is a great little thing. I mean, the women you meet here have all given up sex. And I can see why. The guys are either celibate or impotent. You know, like, you know. You mentioned sex, they start humming memories of the days we left behind. Yeah, this is really good down here, I'll tell you. This is exciting. We wrap. Is there anything else left to raffle off? How about shorts? You guys need any shorts? Or, you know, how about your basic Fruit of the Loom, you know? Only worn twice, you know? I tell you, this is definitely the right place to come, you know. This is it. It's a moving to here, you know. I rented a car about 2 weeks ago in Robert, Rhode Island, and it's a Hertz car, and they have this new thing called GPS, where when you get in it, you punch in where you are. And then it tells you, like you're punching in where you want to go, and it tells you how to get there. And so it had been bad weather, and so I pulled into the car wash. which was a little off the thing I had plugged in, you know. And when I came out of the car wash, a voice came on and says, "Please follow instructions." And I thought, hell, if I had had this car growing up, you know, like, I would have been great. You know, like, I would have known right away I was going the wrong direction. You know, I just would have known right away. I'm one of those guys, I needed a sponsor in grade school. You know, like, you know, I need somebody I could call and say, this is what's going on, and, you know, have them come back and say, Ken, don't worry about it. You know, eat the cookies, take the nap, you know. You know? I mean, that was the deal. I was in Jekyll Island about a month or so ago, and my sponsor was there, and he's been my sponsor. Now, I've been very lucky with sponsorship. I met a guy the first night I was at an AA meeting, and he told me he's going to be my temporary sponsor. And in July, I'll have 30 years. He's still my temporary sponsor. You know, like, I don't know if it's going to work, you know. But he and I just look at each other, and we just start laughing because we know so much about one another. I mean, there is a, like, you know, with some people, you got to have a warm-up conversation before you get into what you're doing. And my sponsor, man, I call him and tell him stuff, and he says, give me a break. Make it a two-call deal. You know, like, you know, call back tomorrow, because he says, I'm at that age, I got to go to the head once in a while. Like, I'm not, you know, but that's just the way it is. You know, it's like one of those deals where you're just tight with somebody. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I heard Mike say last night that if the alcoholic doesn't drink, he tends to act much like other people. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic rests in his mind, rather than his body. And you know, I know about that because the three words you never want to hear an alcoholic say is, I've been thinking. You know, like, you know, we go to a wedding, we want to be the bride. You know, we go to a funeral, we want to be the corpse. You know, and we want to do it humbly. You know, like, yeah, I just want to be me. You know, we scratch shit that don't itch. You know, like, we just have that way about it. You know, we see things, hear things, nothing that's really going on. It's almost like, you know, like, woo, woo, strobe lights. You know, like, I remember one time I was court ordered to a psychiatrist, and he said, now, just relax and tell me what you think. And I said, you got to be kidding me, to myself. You know, I'm already in trouble. You know, suppose, how do you tell somebody, like, well, you know, yesterday I was thinking, if my knees bent the other way, what would chairs look like? You know, like, kind of was just kind of lingering around for several hours, and you know, and I was just wondering what it was about, you know, like, that's all, you know, and that's what was going on up here. You know, I had strobe lights when other people would be talking to, you know. I always like to stand in front of one of these things and not have to enter a plea. This is like big time for me, you know. How'd you like to come out of a blackout behind one of these and everybody's waiting for an answer and you don't even know what the question was, you know, like, and you're looking around like, I wonder what everybody's doing here, you know? And you're trying to think to yourself, is this something that's already happened and it's a continuance and I just stepped away for a moment? Or is this something new that I just got here and it's starting all over again, you know? Like, you know, poo, woo, you know, this is going by you like that. And everybody kind of just looked. My mom just used to look at me and say, you know, like, stop thinking. She knew I was in trouble. If I was thinking, I was placed in some part of the world in danger. You know, like, and my mom understood that right from the get-go. She'd walk into the living room. We had a little 12-inch Admiral TV, and she'd say, turn on that TV, because that would be off. And I'd say, I don't want to turn it on. She'd say, turn it on. You know, most parents are telling the kids to turn it off. You know, like, I'd be in school, and the nuns would be teaching, and there was nothing wrong with them, but my mind would be like somewhere else. I'd be swimming into Ganges or, you know, taking a break somewhere else. And everybody looked at me and kind of said, you know, like, Ken's here, but very seldom present. You know, like, you know, I could just kind of hang out without being there, you know. I developed something. I don't know when it happened. I scare people at meeting with it even today, but I can sleep with my eyes open. And the other night, some lady said, Ken, you're snoring. And I said, I should be. I was sleeping. You just woke me up, you know. Like, you know, but some people that scares because you got this look about you. And And when I'm sleeping and I have that look, it's not nearly so bad as when I'm awake, you know? And people would say to me, you know, it's just your thinking, you know, just your thinking. And that's just the way it was, you know. I had that kind of thinking. You know, it's kind of like the kid who was having trouble with math in school, and the teacher, you know, said to him, you know, I'll help you out here. You know, it was probably somebody as nice as Dorothy teaching him. And I said, I'll help you out here. And she said, stay after school. So the kid stayed after school. And she said, okay, this is going to be a simple math question. She said, now there's 12 birds and they're sitting on a fence. And I shoot seven of them. How many are left? And the kid says, none. And, okay, now I realize I'm going quick. So let me start over again. There are 12 birds. They're sitting on the fence. And I shoot seven of them. How many are left? Kid says, none. She said, how do you get that? He said, well, if you shot seven of them, the rest would fly away. And she says, you know, math-wise, that's the wrong answer. She said, but I really like the way you think. You know? So he said, you mind if I ask you a question? And she said, no. He said, there's three women coming down the street, and they each have ice cream cone. One's licking it, one's biting it, and one's sucking it. Which one is the married one? So she looks at him for a moment and says, I guess the one sucking it. He said, no, the one with the wedding ring, but I really like the way you think. What it's about, you know, it's really mostly about that. It's all about perception, you know. It's like a snail sitting on a turtle's back going wee, you know. It's just the way it is, you know. And that's why I like to come out and do these things, because I love to hear people laugh. I mean, I'd just as soon sit home if people weren't laughing, because who the heck would want to come here, you know? Like the big book says, you know, we are not a glum lot. You know, the newcomer couldn't see some yuck-yucks. You know, why would he want to hang out here? You know, yeah, you want what I have. You got to go through a lot of stuff, boy. Take that smile off your face. So who would want that? I mean, you know, you meet some people, you say, God, I missed their calling. They should have been hemorrhoids. You know, like, just, you know, you know that just the way they are. You know, you look at it and say, huh, yeah, isn't that cute, you know? And the deal is with me, I got here because, I don't know about you guys, I'm a real alcoholic. If the good meetings have a big book, but anyway, in that big book, which I like to call the owner's manual, you know, it talks about a real alcoholic, and that's what I am, you know. Some people looked at the glass and said it was half full. The other said it was half empty. I always thought it was too small, you know, like that was just the way it was with me, you know. You know, I drank stuff that not only hit the spot, it removed it, you know, like that's just the way and I had dependency issues when I was drinking. I'd say to somebody, excuse me, is my fly open? And they say, no. And I say, well, it should be. I'm peeing, you know, like, you know, like a. And that's the way I was. You know, I was. My mom used to look at me and say, "Drunk or sober, you are no day at the beach." You know, like that's just the way it was with me. And as I said, that's why I like to come here, and I love to hear people laugh, because I know some things about laughter that most people don't know. The one important one is you cannot laugh and think at the same time. It is impossible to laugh and think at the same time. So every time you are laughing, you are getting a respite from your favorite topic, which is you. You know? In AA, the theme song should be, I'm always on my mind. I'm always on my mind. You know? And that's just the way it is. And when I got in with guys who were just like me. You know, they thought Moby Dick was a venereal disease. You know, like we had no idea. We used to celebrate birthdays. How long are you sober? You know, like nobody knew. The only thing they knew was that big book. They always talked about the big book. The big book, you know. And my sponsor, I remember him looking at me and saying, you know, the hamster's dead, but the wheel is still turning, you know? And woo, and woo. And you heard the speakers, you know, you heard Railroad Bob yesterday talk about the big book. You heard Mike last night. You heard Rhea and Jenny today and Keith this afternoon. And that's what's really great about Alcoholics Anonymous, because we can come at this thing from 100 different perspectives. But when we get right down to it, it's the big book. It's the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm always amazed, you know, I talk to guys who are, I sponsor a psychiatrist, and the only way he could talk, say less is if he talked longer. You know, like, he's always into theories and concepts. And, you know, I said, just read this stuff, you know. He said to me the other day, this book is vague. Vague. I know you're unscarred by education, Ken, but that means not specific. Vague. So I have one here. I'd open it up and I'd show you. But you open it up and you say, well, let's see how vague it is. I'm going to look at step 11 because you have a lot of trouble with thinking. And let's see if we can make this non-vague to you. Okay, let's read this first part, which is very vague. When retiring at night. Ooh, I wonder when that is. I guess that's maybe when you're going to bed, you know, like, you constructively, not destructively, review the day, you know? And then there's a whole checkoff of things to do, which are kind of vague. Was I thinking about myself? Could I have been kinder? You know, it's a whole checkoff list there. Okay, let's skip over that now. Let's go to this next part. Upon awakening. What do you think that is? You know, like, you think that's like when your eyes open up and you say, hey, I'm upon awakening, you know? Like, I think I'm getting close to awakening right now, you know? You know? And how about this one? It's very vague. When faced with indecision. Whew, I tell you, we're moving so far away, we're in the ether, you know? Like, so what do you think that is? Like when you're confused? Getting the beat here, Sparky, you know, like, you see what's going on here. And during the day when agitated, you know, I don't understand how people can think it's vague. To me, it's always been pretty specific, and I'm totally unscarred by education, you know. You know, that's just the way it is. I mean, Bill and those guys wrote this book for flunkies just like us, you know. They knew who they was going to be writing to. You know, they weren't going to write like E equals something squared. You know, that's not for us. No, it's like... And then they have more specific parts in there. And the deal is that I don't understand where people run into trouble. And I think when they run into trouble is they don't want to do the big book. They want to do something else. Try something else, you know? And that's okay, you know. You don't mind drinking and getting really screwed up, you know, like, you know. But if you're a real alcoholic, that's what this book is about. And it tells you things in there that I just love to read. It says, if you do, when you're doing that 11th step, it says, we, you know, like you hear people say, well, I think, Ken, and I can't get an answer, and I've been thinking and thinking and thinking. Well, come on over here, Sparky. Come on, we got a little line here. Let me introduce you to a powerful line in the big book. It says, we recognize in step 11 that we're no longer calling the shots. We're no longer calling the shots. Let's read this next line. It's very good for you. It says, many times, during the day, many times. Not get up in the morning, get on your knees, do a third step and move on. Many times, many, 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 many times during the day. Many times. It says, thy will be done. That takes you off the hook. See, because you already got a mechanism that you shouldn't be doing a whole lot of this thinking anyway. You know? Because you're just not equipped to do it. You know, like... And that's the way it is. It says many times, many times. And people say, well, in our clubhouse, it says think, think, think. And the old timers told me that they put that there to let the guy know that if you thought about it three times, then it was time to do a third step on it. You know, like, it shouldn't be in your head all day long. You know, you shouldn't be captivated by one thought from the time you get up until you go to bed. I can't think of it. I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. I can't think of it. I don't know what to do. I can't think of it. I don't know the answer. I don't know what to do. I'm confused. I'm thinking about it. Yeah. Then can I assume that maybe you just don't have an answer for this particular problem, and that maybe you're going to have to do something else? And you know, sometimes it tells you right in there, it says alcoholics are undisciplined. We're undisciplined. And that's how God disciplines us. He disciplines us by allowing us to try everything we need to try until we find out it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I go to a lot of meetings, and there should be another tradition. I wouldn't want to change anything in the program except one thing. There should be a tradition. And this tradition should state that when you share, you must listen. You must listen to what you say. Because I go to meetings where people give themselves some great information in the first 2 minutes, and then spend the next 10 minutes refuting the information they just gave themselves. You know? How many times have you heard this at a meeting? I've never been to a meeting where I haven't left feeling better. Every time I come to this meeting, I feel good. Boy, AA makes me feel good when I come to these meetings. I love coming to meetings. It really makes me feel good. I haven't been to a meeting now in 6 months. That wheel is just turning. And you know, you say, how many times are you going to hear that before you get it? You know, if you come to the meetings and you do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what? You're going to get sober. I don't mean to ruin anybody's day. But you're going to get sober. Because in that big book, I'll pretend I have one, it says here in chapter 5 how it works. Rarely, rarely have we seen a person fail. You know, Mike's going to be here 30 years, I believe he said, on the 19th. I'm going to be here 30 years on the 5th of July. And I'll tell you this, I've never seen anybody fail in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've seen people fail to do Alcoholics Anonymous, but I've never seen anybody fail doing Alcoholics Anonymous. Never, never, never. You know? That's the guarantee. They give it to you right there and how it works. They give it to you at the beginning, how it works. It works just fine if you do it. You know, we're kind of telling you up front. You know you're a little dense, you know, but we're going to help you out here, you know. And I watch people come in and they do everything, you know. They get baptized. They get analyzed. They rant. They chant. They meditate. They vegetate. You know, they go to airports and collect money, you know. They heal the inner child. They get in touch with their feelings. You know, and if they have some money, they go to Tibet and Thailand and India and stuff because they know intuitively that God is incompatible with indoor plumbing, you know, and that you can't possibly find God unless you first get hepatitis or dysentery, you know. And then they have their palms red, their cards red, their chakras red, their auras red, and then they stand up and say, it don't work. You know, I understand what you're saying. Let's read this part. Rarely have we seen a person fail, you know. You just can't be running around changing deck chairs on the Titanic and expect to have different results because the whole thing is going down, you know. Nobody cares if you're on the top deck or the bottom deck. You're going to get wet, you know, like that baby's not going to stay afloat. And it's like you say, oh, yeah, I think I'm beginning to get it. Let's read this thing. It says, we suffer from a spiritual malady. Spiritual malady. When that malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally, and physically. This book is about how people get in touch with that concept of God that they call God and the God of their understanding so that they can address the malady. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a museum for saints. It's a hospital for the spiritually sick. And people come here because they don't know why they're coming here. They come here because they think it has to do with drinking. And then when you read that part, let's see, read this part here, Sparky. It says, alcohol is but a symptom. What does that mean to you? Well, I don't know, Ken. It's a little vague. And the deal is that it, and you heard several people talk about it today. Keith mentioned it eloquently this afternoon. And it's that if we do this, we will cease to exist. And that's the whole purpose of being here. The person you brought here has got to cease to exist. Because that person cannot stop drinking. Period. This is not that, it's not easy, but it's pretty simple. You know, people who want to commit suicide, they always get referred to me. I love to work with people who are suicide. Now, I only want to talk to people who are dead serious about it. You know? If you're just namby-pamby and like, yeah, I laid in front of the car in the garage and we back it out, you know. No. But if you are really serious about suicide, I always end up sponsoring a lot of those folks. And I tell them, look, what we can do is we can commit suicide. And the reason people commit suicide is for three basic reasons. Number one is the pain of their life is so intense they can't go on with it the way it is. Number two is they personally don't have a resolution for that pain. And number three is somewhere in the back of their mind they know that if I'm not here, whatever this scenario is will work out better without me being involved in it. That's why people kill themselves. And if you come to me, I'll tell you, hey, look, what we're going to do is we're going to have you commit suicide by taking the steps. Number one is you're going to kill that person who's causing you all that pain. Number two is you're not going to have to worry about the resolution because you're going to be turning it over. And number three is you're going to get to see how everything turns out. You know, you're going to get to hang out here just see how it turns out, you know, and isn't that exciting, you know, so let's get busy killing you, you know. That's a little vague, you know. And the scenario here has always been that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the basic text, and it's always about what works in the life of an alcoholic. Now, if you're a real alcoholic, this is the thing that you need to be doing. And you heard that so eloquently. I mean, I don't know. I just want to clear up a couple of things. One, what Mike said, about celibate. I mean, he's celibate. That doesn't mean all old-timers are celibate. I just want to get that out of the way. Keith was impotent. I don't want to mean that all people who are in AA are impotent. You know, you actually have some people here who are sober for a while who don't suffer from either one of those affirmities. You know, like, I just thought I'd mention that with the 13-step dance coming up. You know, like. And don't worry, I'll end on time. I'll tell you when I'm winding down. Give you plenty of time to strap on your wacko magnet and get out there amongst them. You know, as they say, yeah. Yeah, hear those great romantic songs like I'm just 2 6-packs away from loving you. You know, yeah. So a saddle on the stove, mama, we're riding the range tonight. You know, like all these great love songs, you know. This is the way it comes. But it's very important for the newcomer in particular to get them quickly involved in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because otherwise they start wandering around looking for something to do. And if they wander too far, they can wander right out of existence. And you can teach people here about a whole lot of things, you know, like you can teach them here about love. And love is the most powerful force in the world. There isn't a more powerful force than love. And I go to meetings sometimes now, and maybe you do too, and I hear things like tough love, conditional love, unconditional love. To me, you either love somebody or you don't love them. There's just no other ground. It's just that's the way it is. I read, as Jenny said this morning, I read a book that's not conference approved. It's another big book. But in there's a thing in Corinthians that describes love the best I've ever seen it for me. And it talks about hope, faith, and love. And the greatest of these is love. And when you love somebody, you're just there for them. You're not there to evaluate them, take them apart, change them. You're just standing in their corner. And I'm very fortunate because when I first got here, my sponsor loved me. I didn't know it at the time. I just thought he was kind of sadistic. And I would call him at night and I would say things like, you know, my wife left me. He said, good for her. Good, good, good. So, you know, it's about time she caught a break, you know, like, yeah, and I can't see my kids. God bless them. You see, I knew this thing would start to turn good for them quickly, you know, like, and I'm on my way to jail. Good, because that's where you belong, you know, you belong in jail. You know, that's where you belong, you know, because I used to find things before people officially lost them. And he said, you know, that's where you belong. And he came to see me. When I first got sober now, I was living with my mom in a senior citizen place. And I was the only one in there under 70. And I had been there so long, I could use the walker. I was really lucky, you know. And they told her I had to leave because I wasn't a senior citizen. But I thought I was, you know. I thought I was doing quite well as a senior citizen. The pace seemed to fit me, you know, like you just kind of just moved around and, you know, you drank coffee and you just sat a lot and nobody bothered you. And so I moved in on a place on my own and I had these orange crates as my furniture, you know, freshly decorated with orange crates. And my sponsor came over and God loved me, just loved me. He brought me a little hot plate because I didn't have a stove or any of that stuff. And I had this one Hummel, just a beautiful little Hummel that my mom had given me from my wedding as a wedding gift. And when my wife left with everything else, she said, "Here, you can keep your mom's Hummel." You know? And when he came into my place, you know, I was racked with that newcomer fever, you know, that kind of like a dog on the freeway, you know. You don't have many options, and they're not particularly favorable, you know. And he came in and he'd go to sit down. He said, "Put on some coffee." And I put on some coffee. And he went to sit down. And in order to sit down, he was older than he put a hand on the orange crate where the Hummel was. And I says, "Watch out for that Hummel, if you'd please." He said, "Which Hummel?" "Which Hummel?" So he picked it up and he said, "This one?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh." And he threw it. And it hit the wall and splatted all over the place. And he said, "Ken, you don't have to worry about shit. You know, like, you ain't got nothing now, you know." Somebody break in, they'll leave something, you know, like that. And when I was 25 years sober, several years back, I got a deal at UPS and I opened it up and it was a Hummel that was broken and all glued together wrong. And he said, "See, good things come for those who wait." You know, like, you know? And he and I developed that relationship right from the get-go, you know. You know, he took me on a 12-step call, and on this 12-step call, we had a guy, it was a Sunday afternoon, and we were taking him to the guild in that time in the city, and it was the only place you could take a guy who was really in need of help like he was. There was no, the hospitals didn't have anything back in 70 at that time. And so he said, "You're in charge of getting him in there." So when we got there, he was drinking whiskey and out of a pint bottle all the way up there, and when we got there, he said he had changed his mind. "I don't want to go, you know. I don't really think I got this problem. I don't think I don't want to go in there for 8 or 10 days. So he said to me, "You're in charge." So I popped the trunk. I took out a tire iron. And I said, "Well, you got about a minute Sparky to make this decision. So he started taking my ancestry and saying a lot of stuff, and I just said, well, you're down to about 20 seconds now, you know, like, so at somewhere about 5 seconds, he made a decision to go in there, and he stayed. And he came back to our group and got a 90-day token. And he shared that. He said, the reason I made it this time is because I was so willing right from the get-go. And fortunately, you know, those are the kind of guys, I hung out with. In the city, they never said, go make a 12-step call. They always said, go put the hit on this guy, you know? Describe me, I'm an Alcathoris. Now, if you don't know what an Alcathoris is you're looking at one. I don't have anything against drugs, honestly. I just never used a drug. I never smoked a marijuana cigarette. I never did any of that other stuff. I never did prescription drugs. I never did any of that. I lived in a neighborhood in Brooklyn where there were 5 families, all Italian. And they had guys that headed them called Don, respectively. And if you sold or used drugs in my neighborhood, the first time it was a cordial greeting. They'd open the car door and close it on your hand. And say something to the effect of, you know, we really appreciate it if you wouldn't do it out here. Appreciate, you know what I mean? You know, so you wouldn't do it. Now, let's say you forgot yourself and you did it a second time. We always thought you moved to Jersey because we never saw you again. You know, it was like, what happened to Tony? I think he moved to Jersey. You know what I mean? You know. And so when people say, did you use drugs? I said, no. He said, God, you were right when all the drugs were going on. Yeah, but I didn't use any. You know, I just didn't use any. I lucked out there. I really, really lucked out there. And I hear people today come in, they're looking for a logic. They're looking for logic. Instead of a spiritual remedy, they're looking for logic. Watch my lips, as George Bush used to say. This is not a logical world. If this were a logical world, men would ride side saddle. This doesn't happen. You know? Just not a logical world. In 1990, they announced that the Gulf War was going to start on a specific date in TV Guide. This is not a logical world. Regular programming may be preempted due to the war. You know, this is not a logical world. And if you're looking for the logic, it's just not here. This is a spiritual program. And if you take the word spiritual and you look inside of it, you'll see. Ritual. Ritual. As a ritual to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you do the ritual, you seem to grow spiritually. And the ritual which you heard about from everybody else who has already shared and said it in many different ways, but it comes down to the fact that you have to get out of self. You can't continually be on your mind. You know? You know? In our group, we always look at people and say, you know, there's a lot less there than meets the eye. You know, like that. You know, like, it's just the fact that you've got to do the ritual. And it's always amazing to me when people just don't understand the ritual. You know, and you talk about the miracle of AA. There's a lot of miracles. You know, in the foreword, it talks about the miracle that's happened since this book was put out. But in step 10, it talks about the miracle. It says, you know, your new attitude towards liquor, or our new attitude towards liquor, has been given to us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We're placed in a state of neutrality. We don't have to run away. We don't have to hide. We're in a state of neutrality. We're protected. And we're protected because we're doing the ritual. You know, listen to the people who have problems, who you work with, and your own problems. And see how many times it starts with, I was just on a 12-step call. I just finished turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. You know? And I don't get into that concept thing so much, because concept is, I looked up the word concept, it means of the mind. God is not of the mind. God is an experience. The book says God is a presence. As we become conscious of his presence, we'll lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We'll be reborn. And that's what happens here. You're reborn. You get a new person. You get a chance to start over. This is like a do-over. You know, when we were kids and we played box ball in the alley, or we played stickball and a car came and you had to stop, you got a do-over. Well, this is a do-over, you know. And I remember going to meetings, and I loved the people in the city, because there used to be, at every door there was a greeter. You never got into a meeting without a greeter. And I remember the first meeting I went to was July 5th of 70. And they seemed to know right away I was a newcomer, you know. It was about 108 degrees in New York, and I was wearing a blue wool suit. Everybody else was kind of in shorts. And the guy came on and said, hey, yo, you a newcomer? I said, yeah. He said, what's your name? I said, Kent. He said, Kent, why don't you sit up front? That's where the miracle takes place. So how do I get there from here? You go up front where the miracle is, you know? And they gave me a red name tag, and it said Kent. And I wore that red name tag. I went to that meeting all the time, and everybody always said, hi, Kent, newcomer. And I wasn't wearing the suit anymore. But they always knew I was a newcomer. Always. And then finally I got my 90-day token. And when you got your 90-day token, you could stand up and say, hi, my name is Kim. I'm so glad to get this token. And I thank God for all that he did for me today. And I hope he helps me tomorrow too. And you sit down. That was it. You know? It wasn't a dissertation on where I was or what I had done or where I was going. It was just, you know, say what you got to say and sit down. You know? Quick. And I looked around the room, and I noticed that everybody had a name tag, and theirs were blue. And so I felt something wailing inside of me. You know, I was a great wailer then. And after the meeting, I went up, and I, you know, not for nothing, but how come everybody's got a blue name tag and I got a red name tag? And the guy looked at me and said, Ken, you ready for a blue one? He takes the tag, he gives me the tag. Not for nothing, but you can't slip too much past me. You know what I mean? You know? Just can't do it, you know? And that was my start on AA. And my sponsor used to invite me to come over to his house because my wife had moved back with her mother and kids were out of state and I couldn't see them except every other weekend. And for the first 18 months I was sober, we were separated. And I went to meetings every single night. It wasn't once in a while. Nobody ever said to, I never remember anybody saying, do you want to go to a meeting? Nor do I ever remember someone saying, should we pick you up? When they dropped me off, they, okay, Ken, have a good night. Now, hey, no drinking. And we'll see you tomorrow. I never remember thinking to say, hey, I'm busy. You know, I got some other things. Yeah, let me check my calendar. I'll get back with you, you know. And the next night, they'd be there. And my sponsor had at that time, it was a Plymouth station wagon. It was the first, one of the first 9-seaters that came out. And you had all the seats front facing forward except the ones in the back. One seat that looked out. He said, hey, Ken, get in the back. I want you to see the wreckage of your past, you know? And so I'd sit back there with another newcomer. And we'd talk about what we were going to do when we had a year. Yeah, when I have a year, I'm getting a car. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to tell him where to sit. Yeah. What are you guys talking about? Steps. We're talking steps. And the deal was, is, you know what? We had a bunch of guys. Nobody really knew anything. And somehow we were doing everything. And that has been the thing that has kept us into action, into action. You know, Keith was mentioning today when I heard him about the fact that he said in the big book, you know, like, no sex. People say no sex. I never say that. I never say that. If it's not in the big book, I never tell anybody to do it. Because it may not be bad for some people. But not guys like me, you know. You keep the average alcoholic away from sex for a year. By the time he gets back to it, he'll forget who gets tied up. You know, like, he just won't know. You know, like, hey, I got this cord. Is it your turn, my turn? What do we do? You know, like, what do we do? You know? And I always tell people, I don't care who your sponsor is look. When they tell you to do something, if it sounds fuzzy, ask them to show you in the big book. If it's not in the literature, then it may work for them. But doesn't mean it's AA stuff. I hate to see people go out of AA failing behind something that's not AA to begin with. I'd much rather see him take a shot at the program just the way it is. And, you know, I'm still in that learning stage. You know, somebody said to me, Ken, you don't know anything about sex until you do it in front of a mirror. So I read this chapter into action. So I tried it. I damn near wrecked the car. You know, like... And the thing that threw me off were those side view mirrors. It said objects may appear larger than they really, you know, than they really are. You know, like, wow. You know, this is amazing stuff here. You know, there's a little gal in the back who got sober out in our area. Now she lives back here, Donna, and she used to come to the meeting. We used to go to my noontime meeting. At this noontime meeting, it was like. It was a special kind of meeting because anything that fit under a net was there, you know, like, and we had a guy one day, Jimmy T, he's now goes out and speaks. You may get to hear this guy because he's about 18 years sober now and he speaks around it. And Jimmy, when he came in, had epilepsy and we had him reading one day and he says, if you want what we have, and the book went one way and Jimmy went another way, you know, like, and you see people coming up getting their court slips. It's okay, I'll take it, you know. They really didn't want what we had, you know. Like, and when he was about 4 days sober, he had a little seizure, you know. And we had tin chairs in, and he knocked over three or four tin chairs, and he's laying on the floor. And you know, everybody in AA is a medical doctor. You know, yeah. Put a loafer in his mouth. Yeah. Hit him with the chair. You know, like, tie him up with that wire. You know, yeah. Throw coffee in his face, you know. And finally, Jimmy got it together. He got up, got himself back on the tin chair. And I was leading the meeting. I said, hey, what's your name? He said, Jimmy. I said, Jimmy, if you want to volunteer at this meeting, just raise your hand like everybody else. You know, like, you know, it's you don't have to go through all that. You know, like, you got our attention, you know. And Jimmy told me years later, he said, that meant so much to me at that time, he said, because instead of it being a big to-do, we just had a laugh. Now, 6 months ago, Jimmy T is leading that same meeting, and a guy in the back has an epileptic fit. And Jimmy goes back, and he knows what to do, which is leave him alone. And the guy shook through it, and he got up, and Jimmy walked him outside, and we called the little ambulance and it came and he went off in the ambulance. And Jimmy said, this is amazing. There was an epileptic fit and I got to stay at the meeting. You know, like. And he said, and then he told the story about how when he first came in the deal with me. And the deal is that when you stay here long enough, things happen that are totally unexplainable. They don't need to be explained. And the reason they don't need to be explained is because if you try to put logic into God's spiritual world, it serves as roadblocks, you know? Because the more we try to explain what we don't know, the more confused we become, and we take away from the event itself. You know, the spiritual path is a very simple path. It consists of four basic things, and we do them here in AA. And that is you show up, pay attention, tell the truth, and don't be attached to the results. And that's what you do here. You show up, you pay attention, you tell the truth, and don't be attached to the results. And what will happen is you'll get to see life play out in a lot of different ways. And you'll get to do things that you never, never, never thought you could do. You know, several years back, I was supposed to speak at the Atlanta at the state convention. And I was going to speak on a Saturday night. And the week before I was to speak, I had a calling canceled because my son, who was very, very ill and was on a cruise ship going around the world, came home. And my son, when he left home, was 6'4", about 195 pounds. And when he came home, he was down to about 145 pounds. He was in full-blown AIDS. And I got to pick him up and take him to my place and be with him for the next 2 months while he was alive. And every day I got to do something that no parent really plans on doing. And by the time he died, he weighed about 85 pounds. And he had everything. He had Kaposi sarcoma. He had cystic lung. He had a brain tumor. And it was just watching this kid go down the tubes. And nothing that anyone could do. Absolutely nothing that anyone can do. And I got to see a whole lot of things work out in my own life. First of all, the paradox. He was so lean that sitting on top of any kind of a bedpan was just too impossible. So he would crawl to the bathroom, and I would put comforters and pillows down on the floor, and he would literally crawl and then fall asleep and eventually get there and go to the bathroom. And I got to see my son, 29-year-old son, crawl on the floor to maintain his dignity. And it came to me very clearly one day when he was doing this that I had crawled on the floor and lost my dignity. And here was my kid doing the same thing for a whole different reason. And the reality of that was that I got a whole lot of things in my life that I could not put into words today, and I won't even try to. But I have a lot of guys, they don't, you know, they're kind of like millennium guys. You know, they do half the cooking and they do half the wash, and they're all single and live alone. So, you know what their place looks like. So, and they would come over to my house and help me. I had my former wife came to my house. I got to meet my husband-in-law. I mean, it was a scenario you just can't imagine. Just cannot imagine. You know, in AA, we talk about that poem, Footprints, where there's footprints in the sand, and when the going gets tough, there's only one set of footprints. That was not my experience. My experience was there were footprints all over the place. People just showed up and helped. And my wife and I got to go through this thing. In fact, my son had a great sense of humor. As long as he was conscious, he had a sense of humor. And one night he was running a fever, and we were rubbing him with alcohol and stuffing that ice around him and doing all this stuff to try to bring the fever down. And his brother was there, and I was there, and his mom was there. And about 4 a.m, the fever broke. And he looked up, and we were at the bottom of the bed. And he said, "Wow," he said, "this fever is really something." He said, "I'm having a vision of a nuclear family." And, you know, and he was just this solid kid. And he was my baby. And when my wife and I divorced, the two boys stayed with me. So this was not a youngster from afar. This was a youngster who I made his lunch and sent him off to school. You know, I got to be there at the ball games when he was playing ball. I got to do a lot of things that a lot of dads never got to do. I had sold a little company I was running, and it seemed like I was okay for a while financially, and this is what I wanted to do. And then during that same time, show you how God has a sense of humor, I went to volunteer in the hospice program. And I started working with people terminally ill. And I had no idea in 83 that in 93, 10 years later, my son would be in a bed in a hospice and he would die there. I had no way of knowing that. That was a bang shot that God did that I had no way of knowing. And all the time that that was going on, I would sit in a chair sometimes and just be overwhelmed with it. Just totally overwhelmed with it. If you've ever been a constant caregiver, you have a feel for what that's about. There are some people talked about it today. And the reality of that was, is that every day this disease came in a different uniform. So it wasn't like fighting the same disease every day. Every day was something different. And I remember guys coming over and just sitting there and hugging me. And these are guys that are not huggers, you know. And the reality of my life is that I got a perception and an understanding of God that I never got when I was going to parochial school. And it wasn't their fault. But I got to see God as a presence. And when my son died, A couple of days before he died, we moved him from the hospital where he was in intensive care to this hospice. And we sat on the bed, his mom and I, and because they stopped all the medication, we voted on stopping all the medication, he had a moment of clarity. And he came out of this little coma he was in. This was 4 days before he died. And he looked and he said, where am I? And I said, in the hospice. And he knew right away what that meant. And he rolled his head from the pillow on this side to the pillow on the other side. Now, growing up, I had heard in parochial school and I had heard people many times talk about being in this world but not being of this world. When he rolled his head over, he was in this world. And when he rolled his head back, he was of this world. And he looked up and he touched my hand and he said, I'm okay with this, Dad. I'm good to go. And he was. And my wife was there and his brother was there. And he said, what should I do? And we told him, you know, you've been through enough with this thing. Why don't you just let go? You know, it's time to let go now. You've taken enough shots with this. And just let go. And he said, is there anything else we should do? And we said, well, don't know where you're going, but if it's possible, when we come there, come to meet us. And he said, you got it. And closed his eyes, and that was the end of that. And when he died, we were sitting on the bed. I had one hand and his mom had the other hand. And she looked up at me and she just started crying. And she said, the baby's gone. And we stood up and we went outside. And I went back in because I had promised him I'd take the two hairs he had left and comb them. And I did that. I didn't want him to be thinking I'd forgotten my promise. And then we got to go down the hall, she and I, and make amends to each other. About, you know, like if there's ever anything that we did to each other, let's just leave it all here. Because we just don't want to carry anything extra leaving out of here. And we had a chance to do that. And you know, in my sobriety, I've been very, very lucky. Very lucky. I have so much to be grateful for. I've always been around the nicest people. Always. I've always been with people who cared. And when I look back at growing up, it was the same way. You know, I grew up in a neighborhood where if you move the wrong way, you may never move again. And even the bad guys, you know, they used to say things like, hey, he fell asleep in the trunk of a car, he deserved to be shot. You know, like that was the theory. And even the bad guys, I remember going to a guy, I was running numbers, and I was failing math in school. And I was making about $100, $100 and a quarter a week running numbers. And the teacher told me, she said, you know, you're never going to be anything unless you learn this math. And she was making about $25,000, $33,000 a year at that time. I didn't want to tell her I was making $2,000 more than her, but, and I was failing. But I went to this guy and I said to him, his name happened to be Tony. I said, Tony, do you believe in God? And do you believe in the devil? Is there a heaven? Is there a hell? He says, of course I believe in God. I said, do you think he ever loses to the devil? He said, you gotta be kidding me. He said, do we ever lose? I said, no. He said, you think God's going to make up a game he loses? And I remembered that, you know. And I can tell you here tonight, and put your mind at ease, is God is in such hot pursuit of all of us that nobody eventually escapes. He's in such hot pursuit, nobody escapes. And the deal is, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about this stuff. Sometimes it gets to be old hat. You know, we just take it for granted. We don't realize when we read how it works, what we're really reading is a formula that has done more to save more alcoholics than anything else since the recorded history of man. It's just like casual because we're used to it. It's the big book, you know. You know, you get that for $6 in the big book. You know? And it says things like we've tapped an inner resource. And you know, I started going on silent retreats because words always got in the way with me. There seemed to be too many, and everybody had their own perception of what you were saying. Words were kind of like greased sledgehammer handles. You know, you couldn't get them where you wanted them to go. And I started going on these silent retreats, and I did one for a day, and then I did one for a weekend, then I did one for 4 days, then I did one for a week, and then last year I did one for a month. And there's a sound of silence, and the sound of silence is God speaking. And you can't hear that sound if you're busy doing a lot of other stuff. Now, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of stuff that can keep you busy in this world. It's not bad stuff. It's just distracting. It takes you away. You can be very responsible in life, and in the final days of your life, find out you've been totally irresponsible because you haven't focused on the things that really make life life. If your chief occupation isn't your life, then what would it be? And, you know, I go to a lot of funerals, and I've never seen luggage racks on a hearse yet, you know? I've never seen a U-Haul hooked onto one. You know, it's like they just don't do that. So whatever you give away here is what you get to keep. And what you try to keep, you end up giving away at the end anyway. And the bottom line is you don't get to take anything out with you. And this whole deal that we have here, this little Bozo AA deal, is designed for Bozo people who, not knowing the way, get shown the way. And they get shown the way by the people in front of them who are doing the same thing. And sometimes you'll say to somebody, why are we doing this? And they look at you like, who cares? It works, you know? Who cares, you know? And I see it now more and more, the importance of silence. You know, I hear them announce now at meetings, please turn off your beepers. Please turn off your phones. Please, the technology is such today that noise infringes everywhere. I think it was Jenny in her Al-Anon talk was talking about even the gas pump talks to you. You know, like, you know, everything today is noise and it just keeps coming at you and it's coming at you more. And, you know, I don't own a cellular phone. There's nothing against them. I mean, a lot of people need them. I just don't own them. My son kids me. He says, you know, you're the only person I know doesn't have a cellular phone, a beeper or a computer. He says, what really ticks me off is you're really happy. You know? It's not about going faster. It's not even about going forward. It's about being aware of what's going on. And in order to be aware, you can't be distracted all the time. And that's why many times during the day, you've got to allow time to say, thy will be done. Thy will be done. And I never heard, don't get into the concept of God. Somebody said, well, your concept is, who cares? The nature of God is always the same. The nature of God is love and care. And that's what we want to focus on, the nature of God. Leave the concept out the door, you know? And I have so much fun with the guys I sponsor because I sponsor such an array of guys. Keith may not remember, but I introduced him to a guy I sponsored last week when he was out in San Diego. And this guy's Persian. He's Iranian, but he tells everybody he's Persian because of the hostage thing. And his name is Sam. Sam. I mean, it's a... Everybody I know got an alias, you know? And I had a guy knock at the door one night. And Sam was in the bedroom, and he was doing his prayers. And he had brought over a pizza, and we were going to watch the ball game. This guy knocks at the door and says, you got a minute? I said, sure. He said, he's a newcomer. He says, I'm having trouble with this God thing. And just then, out of the bedroom, you hear, whoa. He says, what the hell is that? I said, it's Sam doing his third step. You know? He left. He just ran away. You know, he just got up and left. You know? And sometimes God will do that. But don't worry about it. Alcohol will bring him back. You know, alcohol, the lash, as the book said, of alcoholism will bring him back. I have pictures, and I just show pictures to guys. Like, when guys say, you know, Ken, I think this program could work, but I think I can do it on myself because I've been able to stop for 6-7 months at a clip. So I have a picture of a guy, he's on a horse, and he's gone off a cliff. And he's sitting in the saddle, and he's got the horse by the reins yelling, whoa! And I said, that's a guy trying to get sober by himself. The horse doesn't know when to stop. You know, he'll bottom out. And it'll be a big splat. And he'll be in charge the whole way down. Whoa, whoa, whoa. You know? And I got all these little toys around the house. Like, you know, I got snow scenes that you come in and you shake them up. And this is heavy stuff for newcomers. Let's shake it up. Okay, I'm shaking it, Ken. Yeah, okay. And what do I do? Put it on the coffee table. Okay, now what do? We watch it. You know, so a couple of minutes, it all settles down. And I said, see, in life, the natural state is bliss. We can shake it up any way we want, but the minute we leave it alone, it's bliss. 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 Many, many, many times during the day. Bliss. Bliss. You know? And it's tough for newcomers to get that stuff. It really is. And I have a little Chinese thing where you put your fingers in, you can't get them out. And I say, pull harder. You know? I can't get them out. How do you get them out? Pull harder. And then sooner or later they say, why don't I just relax? Aha. Sometimes doing nothing is great. You know, the toughest thing for an alcoholic to do is to be still. It's a death-defying act. You know, and it's another prayer. It says, be still and know that I am God. Oh, no, 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 no. You know, I can't be still. And that's the truth. When you first get here, how do you tell somebody to be still? They can't do it. They just can't do it. But you know, when I got here, this kind guy who's my sponsor, he said to me, you know what, Ken? You're a wild man. You're a psycho in a suit. You know, you're a wild man. He said, but I can guarantee you this. If you stay here and you take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and you practice these principles to the best of your ability, you're going to be a disciplined wild man. And you're really going to be somebody worthwhile knowing. He says, on the inside, you're going to be very comfortable with who you are. And you know, that's happened. That's happened. There was a guy, Pythagoras, and he came up with this theory called the cosmos theory. And the cosmos theory is that everything is in order. The planets are in order. Everything's in order. And inside is chaos. Inside of human beings is chaos. And it's our deal. We create it. You know, Bill in his story has some powerful stuff. He says when he stood there in that Winchester Cathedral at one point, he asked for and he needed God. And he said, I had the willingness and the humility for him to come. And he came. And then the next line says, but his presence was soon blotted out by worldly clamors, most of which were within myself. I looked up that word clamors. Clamors means constant noise. There's a lot of noise. You can be very, very busy accomplishing nothing. I notice that nobody's doing anything and everything seems to get done. You know, and slowing down, being still. And today I have that. On the outside, you see me, I'm as wild as I've ever been. But inside where I live, I'm as comfortable as I've ever been. And a lot of things have happened. A lot of things. I had a brother and sister both die a week apart from this disease. One Christmas Day, one New Year's Day. I had a sister take a life behind this disease. My mom gave up and she died. I mean, I know what it is to hold. My dad died when I was a kid and I got to hold him in my arms while he was dying. And I watched him flail for about 3 minutes and die. And the doctor, when he got there, said, well, he didn't suffer. And I figured he never saw his eyes. Never saw his eyes. And I'm going to tell you this tonight, not because I'm volunteering for anything, but I'm as good to go now as my son was the day he left. I owe nobody anything. Life has given me so much more than I ever anticipated. Nothing in my life has worked out the way I planned it. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. If I thought it was going to happen, it didn't. It just didn't. And yet it's worked out perfect. It's just worked out perfect. There's really nothing else to do except nothing. You know, being a human being rather than a human doing. And if you have any amends to make, you know, I would suggest you make them quickly, you know, and basically get them out of the way so you're good to go too. I work with people who are on their deathbeds and they suddenly remember things that they wish they had done. And now's the time to do them while you can. And realize that we're only here for a blink. This thing is only a blink. You know, I don't mean to be negative, because to me it isn't negative, it's reality, that if you love someone, I don't care who you love, if you love another human being, I can tell you three things that's going to happen to that person. They're either going to die, change, or leave. And if you can't live with that, then you don't know how to love, because love is being able to accept any one of those that happens. Not in the moment, but being able to accept it, because you're not in control anyway. You know? It's kind of like a flea sitting on a log coming down a river. And every now and again, the log goes around a bend in the river, and the flea thinks he's steering. If he's alcoholic, he probably buys a commander's coat, a captain's hat, and a whistle to open the bridge, you know? But that's the deal. And we got to take real good care of one another here, because we're only on loan. And I want to thank you for letting me come out here tonight. It's been a great weekend for me. I mean, seeing Keith, who I love, and just saw last week, I saw Marcia, who spoke out in our area. I really enjoyed Mike's talk last night, and Rhea this morning, and Jenny, the Al-Anon speaker. God, she's a hoot. Woo! I think she's about a six-pack away from being on the other side of the room. And I want to thank Mike for being such a great host, and all you folks for being here. And if I could leave you with anything, it's this. It's a mystical prayer I read, and of course it's anonymous. And the prayer goes like this. You cannot see it, nor can you catch hold of it. In not being able to get it, you get it. When you are speaking, it's silent. When you are silent, it speaks. God bless you.